This afternoon, I'm joined by Maya Ramnath. She is a UCSC grad student and activist in the global justice and anti-war movements. She has traveled to the West Bank twice to volunteer with the ISM, most recently in December 2004, January 2005. The ISM, or International Solidarity Movement, was founded in late 2000 by Palestinian and Israeli peace activists who came together with the intent to end Israel's military occupation of Palestinian lands, which they say is the main obstacle to peace in the region. Civilians from all over the world travel to the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem to provide protective accompaniment for Palestinian civilians as well as engage in acts of nonviolent direct action. Some of the work of the ISM Internationals includes acting as observers, attempting to protect Palestinian homes, crops, and water wells from destruction or appropriation, assisting farmers in the olive harvest, riding in ambulances, and carrying food and medicine into closed areas, as well as getting news reports out. Some ISM activists have been killed or seriously injured while engaged in this work. An Australian ISM volunteer sustained severe internal injuries after being hit by shrapnel from rounds fired by Israeli forces during an April 2002 protest in Beit Jala. On March 16, 2003, ISM volunteer Rachel Corey was killed in Rafah after being run down by an Israeli army bulldozer that was set to destroy the home of a Palestinian pharmacist. 3 weeks later, on April 5, 2003, ISM volunteer Brian Avery suffered extreme facial injuries after being shot by machine gun fire from an Israeli armored personnel carrier. 6 days later, British ISM volunteer Thomas Herndahl was shot in the head by an Israeli sniper whilst trying to protect Palestinian children from Israeli army gunfire. He was left brain dead for months and eventually died on January 13, 2004. Today, I'll be talking again with Maya Ramnath, and she, as I mentioned, traveled to the occupied territories in December and January most recently. That was her second trip there. And she went to work with the ISM. And I want to welcome her to the studio today to talk about her experiences working there.
Thanks for having me here.
Can we begin if you could just tell my listeners why you went and why you decided to go with the ISM?
Yeah, well, as I said when we were talking before, I went, it sounds a little maybe cheesy and naive to say this, but I really feel strongly that I hate colonialism. I hate the capitalist system that supports colonialism. And I feel that as a U.S. citizen, I am complicit in that system that's dominant in the world today. And that if I didn't take a stand to do what I could, what I had the opportunity to do to counter that, to resist that in some way, then I am inevitably going to be part of perpetuating it. So that had kind of been in my mind for a long time. And taking whatever opportunities I could to work on that. And ISM, when I learned about it and was very inspired by what people were doing, seemed like an ideal opportunity for me to be able to go to a really key point in that structure of global oppression and where I had the opportunity to go and do something that really made a difference. So I was very happy to take that opportunity.
How do you feel that you made a difference?
Well, sometimes it's really easy to get depressed and discouraged when you're doing this kind of work because it just goes on for so long and it often seems so hopeless and like nothing ever changes. But for me, it's important to remember that to not get this sense of grandiosity that's not about me. It's not like I'm going to go in anywhere and save the day as an individual, but that I'm part of a chain. I'm one link in a chain, or I'm one little stone in a great wall, and I myself am not going to make a difference. But if many, many people do a small bit and don't let that link in the chain break, then that's something I feel pretty good about.
Give me some specific examples of some of the work that you did. First, maybe you could start by saying the amount of time you spent the first time you were there and then the second, and then tell me what were some of the things that you did in both of your trips there.
Yeah, both times, this is an example of why the link in the chain is that both times I was only there for about 3.5 weeks. But that's exactly one reason why I felt that ISM was a good way for me to go. because it's a structure that persists in which you can say, you know, I'm very willing to offer my body, my presence, my awareness for that period of time, and, you know, take my, like, a, you know, carry the baton and the relay for that amount of time, and then know that you can hand it off and that there will be accountability and that that will continue and that I can come in and do another shift later. So that's kind of what I was alluding to about being a link. But yeah, both times I was there for about 3.5 weeks, and they were very different experiences, partly because of the political situation at the time. The first time I was there was April 2002, during the time that I was there, things really, really escalated in terms of oppression. There was a major military incursion, which is known now as Operation Defensive Shield, during which the Israeli military occupied all of the major cities in the West Bank. There was destruction on a huge scale, and people still kind of look back to that moment as a real increase in the seriousness of the stakes of the struggle. So it was a real crisis situation, and kind of all the rules suddenly flew out the window, and no one knew what was happening from day to day, and we did what we could to fill in. And so I did. That's when I rode in an ambulance with the Red Crescent, tried to get food and medicine to people, tried to get people to hospitals when they needed it, tried to get into closed areas, just kind of watched out for people under curfew, and stayed with families in a refugee camp outside Bethlehem. This time, things had returned to quote-unquote normalcy. This was December 2004 to January 2005. And I was much more mobile for this time. The first time I was mostly in the Bethlehem area and then also up near Jenin for a short time. This time I was mostly in the Nablus area and Balata camp, which is outside Nablus, but did a lot more traveling. But the normalcy, what passes for normalcy, I think is really important to emphasize how unacceptable that really is. Like, I traveled a lot, yes, but travel is a huge undertaking, even for someone who bears a U.S. passport. To get from, say, Jerusalem to Nablus, which should maybe take, you know, a couple hours. Well, no, actually, I don't know the mileage. It should maybe take half hour, 45 minutes, but it takes at least 3 hours. You have to pass through 3 to 4 checkpoints, maybe some flying checkpoints. This is, as an international, you pretty much don't worry too much about getting through, but it's a major undertaking to get from place to place. Moreover, if you're living in a refugee camp or in a town like Nablus, there's troops coming in every night on a regular basis, doing acts of provocation, throwing tear gas, throwing sound grenades. Assassinations happen, people get arrested, houses get broken into by the military. This is normalcy. This is kind of just what people are forced to take for granted as daily life, and that's really not acceptable.
You say when you went the first time that one of the things that you did was ride in ambulances. Can you talk a little more in detail about that?
Yeah. During that time, not all of it was emergencies, too, I should emphasize. That it a lot of times it's just that people who are stuck in their homes when there's a full-on military invasion and curfew and they have no way of getting out of their home safely because you could be shot by going out into the street. So sometimes it's just routine medical care, like people who need insulin shots or dialysis or things like that, or just their medication. So the ambulances kind of take people back and forth, or if there's pregnant women or just people that need safe passage for medical care. And it had been found that when ambulances had started to be subject to coming under fire, EMTs and doctors were shot on some occasions. I myself saw an ambulance, or the remains of an ambulance, that had been crushed by a tank, and all the people at the hospital verified that. So we found that when internationals were riding in the front cab of the ambulance, that seemed to be somewhat of a protection for so that the people in the back of the ambulance, the people that needed care, and then also the medical technicians were less subject to harassment and violence. So the internationals who were there started to go in shifts and, like, kind of sleep at the hospital and then go out whenever there were calls, emergency calls, or just any call for the ambulance throughout the night. So I rode along and got to see quite a lot of the destruction around the area.
Were you ever in an ambulance that was pulled over?
Yes, actually I was. Throughout the night, there was an occasion when the army, this night, we were passing near Dehesha camp, where there's also, that's always a place where supposed to be, there's people that resist there. So the army tends to harass it a lot. And as we were passing near there, we were stopped by a jeep, an army jeep, who had kind of set up kind of a, you know, makeshift little checkpoint roadblock there, pulled us over, got everybody out of the back, which was a doctor, and I think that it was a young man and a young woman and a doctor in the back, and then me and then two medical technicians in the front. So the soldiers got everybody out of the ambulance, lined them up against the wall, started not strip searching, but patting them down, and then made the woman kneel down and open up her bag and go through her bag, and then stood behind her and started to shoot, to fire shots directly over her head from behind her, to the point where she was trembling and crying every time the gun went off right over her head. And then they would kind of taunt her with, like, why are you crying? What's wrong? Don't be afraid. And then they started to question everybody, look at their identification papers, at which point the medical technicians and I had kind of been waiting for my moment to kind of step in. But I was also afraid of, I didn't want to exacerbate things either. So when it seemed to be a good moment, I kind of made it clear that I had a U.S. passport and was watching everything, and they backed down. I mean, they, to save face, they didn't immediately back down, but they kind of, things de-escalated from that point. So I never have any way of knowing for sure if things would have been different if I or any other international hadn't been there. But the people in the community who asked for our presence when they needed it seemed to feel that was worth that gamble to have us around. And we were always willing to accept invitations when people said, we fear that our house is going to be subject to an incursion tonight. Could we have someone sleep there? And we would always discuss that and say, yes, we'd be happy to come and support you.
Can you describe other instances where you feel that your presence might have reduced the aggression on the part of the Israeli military?
Well, often it's the case that if they stop a van or a service taxi at a checkpoint to harass people and go through people's papers, you kind of, everyone who's in the service will pass up their ID papers to the front and they look through everybody. And it's usually, it seems to be the case that when there's people there who have, say, a British passport, a U.S. passport, or, you know, they know foreign nationals are in there, more often than not, they're not going to make too much trouble.
So what about harvesting olives or doing other daily activities? These are often hampered by, now the wall, but there's been, in the past, things like curfews, or not that these don't still happen, but I'm saying when you were there.
Yeah.
There's things that make daily life difficult. Did you have experiences where you were able to help people with daily just getting by, being able to harvest their crops or tend to their crops or...
Yeah, I was not there during the olive harvest. I got there too late this time, but there was still the kind of the wrap-up operations of that going on. But that's I'm glad that you brought that up. I should just kind of say something about the daily life thing right now, because that's part of what makes life so difficult under occupation that I don't think people here always understand, is it's not just big dramatic things. It's just this daily kind of attrition of... insults to one's human dignity and just harassment and making life as difficult as possible. And people can't get to work. People are all suffering economically because they can't get to where they need to work. They can't get to harvest their crops. They can't go to school. It's just every aspect of life is made as degrading and difficult as possible. So this isn't about olives, but one thing that I did take part in this past time was there's a village called Toulouse and another neighboring village called Assira, and these are both small towns north of Nablus, and they're not anywhere near the fence or the green line or any major settlement, so there's not really a credible security excuse that the army could have used to block off these towns. They're just kind of in the middle of the countryside, and yet... shortly after I got there, these towns were placed under curfew. Final exams were happening at the schools there in Toulouse, but it was all the roads to Toulouse were blocked off. The teachers, who mostly came from other towns, were not allowed in. Students were not able to get to school. So ISM people, in association with a variety of other groups, like Maxim Watch, for example, that means Checkpoint Watch, and a couple of... Israeli social justice organizations who made it known to the media, all of these people kind of joined forces to draw attention to this abuse. And ISM people went to stay in the village and kind of watch the checkpoints and see that the school could open. And there was a lot of, it wouldn't have been able successful without a lot of media pressure, but it did, we did succeed ultimately in opening up, reopening the town. And
I can imagine that one might say, well, you say that daily life is made difficult for Palestinians. This is a grim necessity in order to prevent more suicide bombings. The checkpoints, the restrictions on movement, and the fact that they're suffering economically are due to the fact that they've launched this, you know, violent terrorism against Israel, and this is the unfortunate result of their own actions.
Yeah, frankly, I would never say anything in support of suicide bombing. I think it's a morally and strategically bankrupt practice. But the way that it gets discussed in the media here, I think, really distorts the reality, because nobody launched any aggressive campaign. For one thing, there's so many things I could say about this. For one thing, to say that this comes out of nowhere as some kind of sign of congenital violence, it's very racist, for one thing, but it's just inaccurate. It's not, people are driven to this tactic, which is a horrible idea, but there's reasons why people are turning to it. And this is kind of what I was trying to get at with trying to describe everyday life in normality, is like, all, if someone put it to me once, for a moment, just imagine that who is doing what to whom in terms of violence is not the issue. And imagine the structure, the status quo as it is. Is it an acceptable status quo? And what you see is a situation of military occupation and colonial settlement, which is always on the rise. There's continuous construction of walls that are cutting people off from their cropland, from their communities. There's continual seizure of land. It's very analogous in a way to the settlement of this country, in which the Native Americans were pushed further and further off their land and then demonized as savages for fighting back and insisting on their right to live where they had lived for generations and generations. So I think ignoring the fact of colonial settlement and military occupation really kind of distorts the issue. And another thing to just point out about that is that it's wrong. I think that the targeting of civilians under any circumstances is wrong. Therefore, it is equally wrong to selectively condemn it. And it seems very strange to me that to condemn it on this relatively small scale, done as by a much weaker party, and it's a weapon of the weak, to use James Scott's term about peasant resistance. But it seems very strange to me to condemn that while condoning massive military force, which targets civilians on a very grand scale, institutes collective punishment, home demolitions, targeted assassination, mass arrests, much of which is done upon innocent civilians. And it just seems to me that if you're going to condemn the one, you really have to equally condemn the other in scale and recognize that, you know, the scale of what's being done to each side.
What about checkpoints in particular? Do you think that these checkpoints are serving a security purpose? And just explain what you observed of them.
I frankly don't think they serve a security purpose. People are resigned to them, but it's part of just kind of a system of harassment, basically.
Justify your statement. There's many people who would say, well, how can you say that's not for security? I mean, they're using these checkpoints to check people for weapons. They're preventing them from getting near Israel, from getting near the settlements.
Because they're not just on, say, the borderline, say, the Green Line, which is the 1967 established boundary of the West Bank and Israel, or Gaza and Israel. They're not just on crossing points like that. They're to get from a city to a village. They're to get from
a Palestinian city.
Yes, yeah, sorry.
A Palestinian village.
That's right.
They're within Palestinian areas.
They're deep within Palestinian areas. They're blocking the road. They're cutting the road into bits. They're keeping people from mobility between population centers. They're just, they don't serve any discernible security function because of their location.
I interviewed a woman a few years ago named Mel, who had recently returned at the time. She had spent at least a week, week and a half or so, observing checkpoints and told me that there would be times where people would be held up for hours, maybe even a whole day, in hot sun, piled onto cars because you can't walk through, even though that would make the most sense in terms of checking people individually. And then, all of a sudden, for no reason seemingly, the Israeli troops at the checkpoint who had been hanging around prior, smoking cigarettes and kind of joking with each other or whatever, would suddenly let everyone through without checking a single ID. And she also came to the conclusion from her observations that these checkpoints were not being used for security purposes, at least not within Palestinian areas. She also pointed out that ambulances were not allowed through in several cases when she was present. Once involving a woman in her 70s, another time a boy of 14, both of whom were critically injured and posed no threat. And even after the ambulance was searched for weapons, still not allowed through and turned back. Did you see any of this type of thing when you were there?
Yeah, I didn't spend sustained periods of time watching a checkpoint other than when we were up kind of trying to keep Tallulah and Asira free from curfew, but I didn't do any like sustained periods of checkpoint watching. I did, however, pass through many, many checkpoints during trying to get around. So if I'm gonna like kind of collate all my different checkpoint experiences, plus all like whenever anyone gets anywhere, you're like, oh, how was your trip? Did you have any checkpoint problems? So kind of like collecting everybody's tale of their trip in combination with my experiences. It just, there doesn't seem to be any discernible rhyme or reason to it. It seems completely arbitrary.
Did you protest the wall at all? I know there's a large
yes.
Nonviolent resistance going on to the construction of the wall, which is taking place mostly within the West Bank, not on the Green Line. There's many people who've been cut off from their crops. Even families have been cut in half because the wall, the path of it, goes straight through some Palestinian villages. Many other, dilemmas being raised by this wall. I understand there's a huge nonviolent movement against it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
You participated in some of the protests?
I did. And that's one of the major focuses of joint Israeli-Palestinian activism right now to kind of counter the detriment of the occupation. And there's the wall construction has been underway. It's been growing by leaps and bounds. That was one of the most frightening differences I noticed between my trip in 2002 and then my trip in late 2004, which places where you're not expecting it, and all of a sudden just this blank bisection, just this blind stop in the landscape. And it looks like a concentration camp. It's really, really scary to see how fast it had grown. But I took part in some demonstrations in a town called Jeus, which is close to the Green Line. And in that particular case, the village, it's been the focus of a lot of international attention. And that village has lost so far about 75% of its land. And there's like two openings in the wall, which are opened a couple hours a day for people to pass in and out of. But those two are subject to kind of change without notice. So during the time I was there, there were some large nonviolent demonstrations during which people, in one case, marched from both sides of the Green. It's very close to the Green Line, but still well inside the Palestinian area. But people on both sides, including ISM people, the local people of Jeus, Israeli groups, Palestinian groups, all kind of joined forces and marched to both sides of the wall and met. There were some symbolic olive tree planting, since they've lost hundreds of trees, and it can't possibly overstate the importance of olive trees to Palestinian livelihood.
Well, do you mean they've lost hundreds of trees due to the wall?
Well, they've lost access to their land and water resources and trees due to the wall, but literally, too, the trees have been uprooted systematically.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, a lot of times trees are just utterly destroyed, literally by bulldozer, completely uprooted and torn out.
So what happened when you participated in these activities, as you mentioned, joint activities, Israeli groups, Palestinian groups, ISM?
Yeah. In these particular occasions, we were pretty lucky that there were no arrests and no real escalation on the part of the military. So they were pretty symbolic, but again, in context of ongoing actions and media attention, and not useless. But so basically, we just all got to the wall. trees were planted, people were talked to, and eventually left when people felt that, you know, the media attention had been sufficient and that the statement had been made. But I also know how lucky I was in a way, because both before I got there and after I left, there were nonviolent wall demonstrations at Jeyus, at Bidu, at Budrus, also kind of joint Israeli-Palestinian and other international efforts, which were subject to extreme harassment by the Israeli military, by undercover forces. People were beaten. I'm talking about nonviolent activists were beaten and detained, and some arrested, some deported. In one case, and this is something that I witnessed, not the actual event, but a hearing about the event months later. This was in Bidu, which is near Ramallah. There were some anti-wall demonstrations last summer, during which a kind of a community organizer and social justice activist named Mohammed Mansour was attacked suddenly by Israeli undercover agents and beaten and arrested and charged with resistance, throwing stones, assaulting officers. And I almost had to laugh, because that's so familiar to activists here, how if somehow a police weapon comes into contact with you, then you assaulted the police. But he had a hearing January 2nd when I was there. And any of us who are around ISM people were going to go support him in his hearing. And as we were outside the courthouse in Jerusalem holding signs saying Muhammad is innocent, free Muhammad, it happened that there were also a group of Hebron settlers there who were there for a completely other reason. And the Hebron settlers are kind of known, even among Israelis, as being really fanatical and unreasonable. And I'm kind of looping back around here, but when you mentioned Olive Harvest before, it's not only when we would do accompaniments to Olive Harvest. It's not just to help people get through checkpoints and get through the wall and get to access to their land, but it's to kind of protect them from settlers in many cases, because settlers are in some ways, much more violent and dangerous than soldiers, because they're not subject to military discipline. They're not accountable. And many of them are really extremist religious fanatics who will think nothing of just extreme aggression and violence. They think that's their God-given right. And I'd heard about this kind of behavior, but never witnessed it myself. And this was the last place I was expecting to witness it, outside the courthouse in Jerusalem. So we're here supporting Mohammed Mansour. And next to us was this group of Hebron settlers coming to protest something else outside the courthouse. As soon as they saw us, they pounced and began to, it was very interesting how literal this kind of colonization of space was. They would kind of literally try to push us out of the way, hold their signs up in front of our signs. The young one, yet like maybe, you know, late teens, early 20s, would come up and kind of taunt and scream hateful things at us and blow these whistles in our ears and yell, "Die, Mohammed, die. We want you all to die." And just even the little kids were being encouraged to kind of take our space and hold up signs in front of us. And there was one picture that a companion of mine shot, which showed a mother pushing a child in a stroller with a big Uzi slung over her shoulder. And I was amazed at just the intensity of the hatred I felt towards me.
You mentioned this intensity of hatred that exists among, as you say, some of the, or many of the settlers that you say are quite fanatical. You lived among Palestinians, I would imagine,
yes,
for a good portion of the time.
Yes,
you were there.
Most of the time.
Sounds like you also worked with Israelis. When you were living and staying with and talking with Palestinians, did you experience an intensity of hatred towards Israel, towards Jews, towards Israelis, towards soldiers?
No, I never did. And that was one of the best experiences, is to just to get to spend time with people and have in-depth conversations with them about their lives, about their hopes, about their beliefs. And I have to say that most of the people I talk to have a quite sophisticated political analysis. They're very clear on differentiating between government policies and military policies, and then actual people. They're very happy to engage with Americans and Israelis as actual people, to speak to one-on-one in a respectful way, but they are adamant about not approving of what either of our governments are doing. And
in terms of, you say they have a complex political analysis. What is it our governments are doing that they object to?
Well, none of them have any problem with identifying, well, Israel cannot be carrying out this military occupation without the intensive military and moral support on the international stage of the U.S. Why is the U.S. involved? Oh, it has geopolitical interests. It has oil interests. It has all its own interests in the region. They see all of these connections. They see the effects of colonialism.
What we hear often in commentary here in the U.S. and in general attitudes is that Palestinians are part of this huge sea of, you know, savage Arabs that want to utterly destroy Israel. They don't recognize it at all. Want to completely destroy it and throw all the Jews into the sea. This is what we're fed here in this country repeatedly. Are you saying that's not true?
Yes, I'm saying that's not true among the majority of people in Palestine. The majority of people who I had the opportunity to speak with will say, we just want to live our lives in peace. We have no problem with Israelis living their lives in peace. Why is it that we're continually, that this is denied to us? But I'm not saying that opinion does not exist, because this is one of the things that really hit me after this experience with the settlers outside the courthouse, and also my experience with various people over the past 3 weeks before that. Let me back up for a second. So the first time, my first trip, my only experience of Israelis really was standing at gunpoint, or it was with soldiers who were on, you know, heavy aggression mode. And I never really had the chance to talk to other people who were Israeli. And this time I had the opportunity to speak with people who were doing this amazing work for social justice and working with Palestinians, and real collaborations and real partnerships going on. And it was really good to see, because it just meant, you know, I know this sounds like a tangent, but when I was standing outside that courthouse, it really hit me that if the Israelis are represented by the views of the Hebron settlers and the Palestinians are seen to be represented by the views of, say, Hamas, then there is no hope for rapprochement, because these both represent like the extreme end of non-compromise, of fanaticism. But that does not represent the spectrum of voices inside both communities. And I've never ceased to be inspired by people within both communities on both sides of the Green Line who are doing amazing work for social justice, for transformation of society. And I think it does a disservice to both to cut them out of the discourse, to cut them out of the political process.
Well, you know, a skeptic might say, well, the majority of Palestinians support suicide bombings, do they not? On the other hand, the majority of Israelis may, you know, want peace, but they're not actively pressuring their government to pull all of the settlements out, not some in Gaza or, you know, and leaving most in the West Bank, but all settlements. There's not that active pressure. In fact, there's a lot of protest against pulling some settlements out. So a lot of people here would feel pretty hopeless, and they would say the fundamentalists on both sides are reigning the day right now. You know, you've got Ariel Sharon in power, who is a man known for his massacre, you know, his role in massacres that took place in 1953 and in Sovereign Shatila, his role in the 2002, you know, massive invasion of Jenin and other areas. And on the other hand, you know, until recently you had Arafat, who does have a history of being involved in terrorism, and many people felt like he wasn't honest. So a lot of people don't have much hope, and they think the fundamentalists are running the day there. Now, you've been there. Do you think that's true?
Well, let me kind of take the first part first, which is just that the statement, if one were to suggest that the majority of Palestinians suggest suicide bombing, that's just incorrect. That's just plain not correct. And I would suggest to anyone who wanted to verify that to go there and talk to as many people as you can. And it's really not supported. in most cases, the families of people who do undertake that tactic don't know about it beforehand. They're shocked. They grieve. I know you also hear the rumor that, oh, yes, they raise their children to be this way. Mothers, like, want their child to die. And this is ridiculous. I mean, people who lose a family member or a friend, a relative, a neighbor, are horrified and grieved about that. They do not support the tactic. And more often than not, the entire community then becomes subject to collective punishment. So speak to as many Palestinians as you want to if you want to verify what the majority view is on that.
What did people tell you?
You mean Palestinians? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of anyone I talked to who would support that tactic.
Did people oppose it?
Well, in terms of, like, are you going to stop someone? I don't know if you can stop people, because, like I said, like, most of the time, you don't know that you hear about it afterwards.
What did they have to say about it is what I'm asking.
Okay, yeah. Here maybe is the opportunity to make a distinction, which, again, most of the people that I talk to, the Palestinians that I talk to, would make, between the right to armed resistance and then the decision to attack civilians within somebody else's city. And I think they very much support their own right as a people to resist. And this is in line with international law. This is recognized internationally, that anyone who is subject to military invasion has the right to armed resistance. But I think that's a very different thing than undertaking attacks on non-combatants. And they make that distinction very clearly as well.
The International Solidarity Movement says on their website that they recognize the right to legitimate armed resistance. And that statement has brought a lot of criticism,
yes.
Has brought a lot of claims that the ISM supports suicide bombings. Can you clarify that?
Yes. Well, for one thing, as I just said, I think that suicide bombing of civilians is a very different thing than taking up arms when soldiers come into your hometown. Are you going to, that's a really different thing than fighting back against soldiers who incidentally have much greater weaponry than you do. I think I don't see what's wrong with that personally. And let me say, when I was there this past time, I had the opportunity to visit with the family of someone who had died in suicide bombing, who had actually carried it out. I think it was a couple of months before. The family did not know that their son was going to do this. He was very young. I think he was, I don't want to say, I can't remember how old he was, but he was a young teenager. And we visited with the family and close neighbors. They had not known about it beforehand. Their home was demolished afterwards. However, all of the young man's brothers were arrested. I believe that 4 people in the neighborhood were killed during the collective punishment. So, and then the family, and ISM does not support suicide bombing as a tactic. It does not support suicide bombers. However, it is very willing to give moral support to the family who's lost a loved one and then is subject to oppression. So anyway, I was talking to one of the, I don't even know if it was a relative or a close family friend or neighbor, because, families are big and neighborhoods are close. But this man was asking me, first people are always interested to hear where you were from. And whenever you would say you were from the United States, you could kind of see this buzz pass through. And then once you clarified, if I said, yes, I'm from the United States, but I do not support George Bush or his policies, that's why I'm here, then people, kind of their defenses went down and they really wanted to talk to you about, why do Americans hate us? Do you understand what's happening here? You have to go and tell your government. You have to go and tell the people in your home. Unless you change things in the United States, things will never change for us here. And this relative or friend said to me, I want to ask you this. I want to ask the Americans this. If someone came and attacked your homeland, if someone came and killed your family, what would you do? Would you fight back? And I said, you know what we would do. You know what we did. Not only did we fight back, we used the opportunity to become aggressors and return, tenfold, 100-fold what we'd received. So it's very hypocritical of U.S. policy to call this evil when that is exactly what they did. And, and they feel very justified in, this is our home. We're going to defend our home.
One of the founders of ISM is Adam Shapiro.
Yes.
And I had the opportunity to interview him a couple of years ago, and I asked him about that statement on the website, and his response was that recognizing someone's right under international law to legitimate armed resistance is not the same as supporting it. Recognizing
he clarified
that legitimate armed resistance, they meant that which is legal under international law,
yes,
which does not include attacks on civilians, suicide bombings that target civilians, or other attacks on civilians. The thing is, though, is that statement can be easily twisted to mean something else.
Yes, it can, and that's a good clarification. And yeah, recognizing is not the same as supporting. So ISM has a very strict policy of distancing itself from any kind of armed activity at all costs, partly because it believes very strongly in nonviolent civil disobedience. That's part of its founding principles. It takes it very seriously. But because everybody knows how easy it is to make things look a different way, to twist things, we have to be extra, extra careful to be beyond even the suggestion of reproach on that. So we never, ever get involved. We stay out of the way if we know there's going to be resistance fighters in an area, not only to keep out of the crossfire. And it's not always possible to keep entirely out of the way. I mean, when I was in Balata camp this last time, often there were young armed fighters around. And there were incursions into the camp every night, almost every night, by army jeeps kind of taunting and provoking and trying to get the resistance to kind of rise to the bait, which, to do them credit, they did not. I just kind of lost my train of thought there. But yes, ISM does everything it can to completely, not only on principle, but because it knows how easy it would be to make it, even if unfairly, make it look bad.
The funny thing to me, there's been many accusations thrown at the ISM claiming that there was a gun found in an ISM office. That was a claim by the Israeli army. They had to retract that. It was false. They also claimed that ISM had something to do with two suicide bombers that carried out an attack at Mike's place in Tel Aviv. They based this on the fact that these two bombers had went to an ISM office prior to the bombing and had tea and spent, 20 minutes or something in the office. They'd also attended a vigil for Rachel Corrie. The ISM members had no knowledge whatsoever. These people had an intention to do this, but yet they were told, we were told this meant that they had some connection to it. But in any case, And by the way, they stated that if they had known any such thing, they would have immediately reported it to the authorities, but they were not told. Of course they were not told. People don't tell a bunch of strangers they plan to blow themselves up, in a suicide bombing. In any case, the thing to me that's really kind of ridiculous about these accusations about the ISM having connections to Hamas and all this is that if there was even a shred of evidence of something like this, the Israeli government and the American government would have shut this organization down a long time ago. If there was even a shred of that, the Israeli government has such an amazing intelligence apparatus and such a long reach in terms of their ability to monitor these things. The best proof that the ISM's not involved in these things is that the Israeli government would have shut this organization down a long time ago if this was the case. In any case, I want to let listeners know that you're listening to 101.1 FM Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm speaking with Maya Ramnath. She's a UCSC grad student and activist in the global justice and anti-war movements. She recently traveled to the West Bank. She's been there twice. Her most recent trip was in December and January. I want to ask you just a few more questions.
Yes.
I know we don't have a lot more time. You mentioned that you worked with a lot of Israelis, and I want to know, did you have the opportunity to spend lengthy periods of time talking to them as well, and what was their take on it, and, just some of the conclusions, some of the feelings from them?
Yeah, I did have a lot of opportunities to talk to Israelis. And, it's silly to kind of generalize to either say, oh, Palestinians think this or Israelis think this, because part of my whole point is the hugely diverse spectrum of opinion that you're going to find on both sides. And one of the things I take back with me the most is how important it is to form alliances and give support to those who, as I said, who on both sides really care about social justice. So, I don't know. Could you clarify the question of what's people's take on?
No, just like what, you know, you mentioned earlier that when you spoke with Palestinians, there was a wide spectrum of opinion. You said that a lot of them wanted you to go home and tell your government your policies here are affecting us this way, that way. You know, they might have talked to you about some of the hardships they were going through. What did Israelis have to say? I'm not saying that what they had to say is going to represent the entire state of Israel, but I'm just curious, you know, I haven't been there, and I'm curious what the Israelis that you spoke with had to say about the, you know, our government's involvement, their own personal experience, what it's like working with Palestinians, what they think about the conflict, what they think might solve it, how they feel about suicide bombing, anything they had to say that might be of interest, basically.
Yeah, I think a lot of people there seem to go through a lot of really kind of complicated, I don't know, soul searching is not quite the right word, it's a bit, I don't know, but it's really hard, I think, to kind of untangle, same as being a U.S. citizen. How do you untangle your own life, your own, you know, right to go about your life while recognizing that you are part of something that you cannot support and you really have major ethical issues with? So I think a lot of people who have, say, for example, soldiers who come back and have seen and participated in things, which, I mean, they know the truth more than anybody does about what the military does in the West Bank and Gaza. So one of the most, I think, hopeful and inspiring and really powerful movements there is soldiers who come back and then refuse to serve, or there's the Refusenik movement has been getting a lot of attention lately, but there's also, there's a group, for example, called Breaking the Silence, which has presentations and exhibitions, and they have kind of printed material of soldiers' kind of confessions and memoirs about this is what happened, this is what I did, this is what I took part in, and some really, really powerful statements on turning towards anti-occupation, anti-military politics. And a lot of also, and in a sense, it gives you more of a moral high ground too, especially like one friend of mine. Oh, now I'm sorry. I'm starting to think about all too many things all at once. But people become very, since you do feel implicated, you do feel that this is, I guess, not in my name is a very overused cliched statement. But I think people then, if you turn to kind of disapproval of this political situation, you have a very strong moral high ground for standing up against it.
So a lot of the Israelis you spoke to kind of had that attitude of not in our name. We know that our government's conducting this occupation. We know of the repression that's going on. We're going to come here and bear witness.
Exactly. Like that this does not represent my principles, my ideals, my religious beliefs. This is a travesty of my religious beliefs. This degrades the memory of our ancestors who died throughout the 20th century. This is, you know, this is a travesty. Not only that, but just from a purely pragmatic standpoint, this is not what's good for the security of the state of Israel and its future.
Did you talk to them about what they thought of Palestinians? And if so, what was their...
Well, again, I'm, you know, I don't give you a kind of the accurate random sample of the population, because the people who I did talk to were the people who were already involved in this kind of activism. So, but again, same thing, like, they're very, they, you know, they treat people as people. They're one, they know people as individuals. They respect them as individuals. They're entitled to human rights, civil rights, partners in working for kind of a restructuring, a more socially, economically just restructuring. But no, but yeah, they will be very outspoken in criticizing, say, Arafat or the Palestinian Authority and calling them on corruption. And yeah.
So would you say that there was actual friendships possibly developed between these Palestinians?
In some cases,
it's hard
romance.
To imagine the way that we see, the way that we're the things we're shown here are so far from that. So you're saying there was strong connections?
Or? Very strong connections. Many good personal friendships and even romantic relationships. In some cases, you know, it's people working together on things that they believe strongly on. You know, how could you not forge good friendships?
So. Wanted to talk a little bit about the fact that when people here in the United States become very, you know, concerned with what's happening there, especially the fact that our government is funding much of it, because yeah. Israel is getting more money from our government and our tax dollars than any other nation right. in the world, and go there to take a stand or help in nonviolent direct action, help in mm-hmm. resistance to the building of the wall, et cetera, et cetera. They get accused of being anti-Semitic. You're singling Israel out. That's anti-Semitic. You're criticizing Israel. Therefore, you're criticizing Jews. You're anti-Semitic. You know, et cetera, et cetera. So how would you react to that? I mean, two-part question. Mm-hmm. Why this issue? How do you justify opposing this occupation, mm-hmm. say, rather than Syria's occupation? I'm not saying you don't oppose yeah, other yeah. occupations, but why
get involved in this
exactly
one.
And the other part is when somebody says you're anti-Semitic because mm-hmm. you work against the policies of the government of Israel and the military in the occupied territories, how do you respond yeah. to that accusation?
Well, in one sense, I would say that well, that does a grave disservice to all of these people that I was already describing, that doesn't recognize the reality of their views, and I think it's also very important to recognize that I or anyone else who criticizes Israel is not criticizing a religion or a people or anything like that. We're criticizing a state which is subject to international law, which is subject to all of the same standards as any other state. So this brings us to the other part, which, yes, this is not the only state in the world who is committing human rights violations, who is committing military aggression. But I guess the reason I would say why would I get involved in this one is because of the intensive U.S. support for it. This is as much a U.S. issue as it is a specifically Israeli issue. I'm a U.S. citizen. I think that this issue is also a keystone to the geopolitical situation. I think it's crucial, which is why it gets so hedged around with such intensive emotion, with such, you know, it has this huge, huge over proportionate weight because it's such an important keystone to the kind of the global structure. And since, as I said, I'm a U.S. citizen, therefore it's my responsibility. I am involved, whether I like it or not. I live here. I'm involved. Someone else asked me too, it would be like, well, you know, why are you here? We, you know, try to kind of, well, how do you answer these questions? I want to help people. This isn't an acceptable situation. And they'd be like, well, there's people suffering in other parts of the world. There's other hunger, there's other suffering. And I guess partly for me, it's that I'm not, maybe this is going to make me sound bad or something, but it's like I'm not a do-gooder. I'm not primarily motivated by charity or where people suffering, I should go there. I go for where do I see injustice? Where can I resist injustice that creates the suffering? And this to me is not only am I complicit if I don't resist, but it is an opportunity where I do have the chance to make a difference. You know, that like I was saying before, ISM provides a structure where I can go and be a link in that chain, do a shift. Mm-hmm.
So what it boils down to is that as a citizen of the United States, you feel directly responsible for
Absolutely.
What's happening there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, our government's policy is extremely slanted toward the Israeli side, and
the level of discourse around it and why it becomes such a hugely divisive issue, so violently emotional here when people debate it, even, you know, that there right there tells you how important an issue it is.
Yeah. You said earlier it's a linchpin of the struggle for global justice.
Yeah, I do believe that.
Can you kind of clarify that a little bit? And that might be another reason you went there.
Let's see. Some of the stuff is like, okay, where do I even start? Yeah. Oh, shoot. I don't even know where.
Is it because the entire Middle East and most of the world is saying this issue is at
yeah,
the heart of
well,
so much of the unrest? And
I do. Yeah, I think it's like if you care about it's all, you know, the occupation of Iraq. If you care about the oil crisis, if you care about you know, the project for a new American century plan to dominate the earth, if you care about, you know, weapons buildup, if you care about any of these things, which are part of a plan of imperialism, I think that strategically that plan hinges on this kind of, you know, this ally in the Middle East.
So then what is your suggestion? I'm assuming what you're saying then is that a fair and just political solution to this conflict would in some way improve the situation that you're describing. What kind of settlement would that look like? In your opinion, I know you're not Israeli or Palestinian, and many people will say it's up to them to decide mm-hmm. the ultimate political solution. But just, you know, hypothetically, what do you think would be a fair and just solution to this conflict that might possibly have, you know, like,
yeah,
waves of good ramifications?
Well, I mean, ultimately, in a utopian sense, again, I guess now that this is reminding me that a lot of the people I talk to, both Palestinian and Israeli, who are going to speak in like what would be your ideal in a perfect world, would say to not have two states, to have one region where a multicultural, diverse area where people can live, practice their culture, practice their religion, all in peace and tolerance with each other. But then, you know, followed by, well, realistically, given the history, given the quagmire to which we've been reduced at this point, pragmatically, given everything that's happened, that maybe the best next step would be to have two autonomous, viable states based on the 1967 borders of the Green Line. West Bank and Gaza, all settlements pulled out. I mean, that this is kind of the bottom line, is that like whenever there's been a ceasefire, quote unquote, during this last ceasefire, which Palestine was accused of violating, during the time of the ceasefire, there were, as far as I know, 8 civilian Palestinians killed. And then during during all other ceasefires, construction of the wall continued, settlement expansion continued, incursion into Palestinian areas continued. All of this continues. So I think if unless settlement is pulled out, occupation is pulled out, peace doesn't mean just cessation of resistance. Peace doesn't mean quiet. Peace means justice. Peace means there's a situation in which resistance is not called for. So I think that the kind of the bottom line for even a place to start needs to be all settlements pulled out of Gaza and the West Bank and establish an autonomous Palestinian state with continuous, not the Bantustans that were, you know, represented in the Oslo plan.
Some people would say that the Israeli state would be under threat from Palestinian state. How would you remedy that? United States has said they guarantee the security of Israel, mm-hmm. so I don't really know what the fear there is.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the threat would be as long as people are left in peace. They don't want to be aggressive. They just want to be left in peace, basically, at that point. This, again, is a kind of a recurrent opinion I heard throughout many conversations is, you know what? We're tired. We just want to be allowed to live our lives. We don't want to, you know, we're happy to let the Israelis live their lives. Just let us, please, live our lives. Give us a place where we can live here in peace and quit trying to take it all away from us.
As far as I know, Israeli Arabs, those who are citizens
yes.
within Israel, have not been responsible
yeah.
for suicide bombings.
No.
Also, Hamas and Islamic Jihad didn't exist before the occupation.
No, so. And all of the most of these, it kind of flips things on its head to say, well, we need to construct the security barrier. We need to crack down on security because we're trying to prevent suicide bombing. Yeah, I mean, resistance like that, those forms have, and militants have really been on the rise as a response to increased oppression. People turn to more and more desperate measures, especially if this is another thing why what ISM tries to do is they're saying, everyone keeps saying, why must they insist on violence? Why don't they turn to other kinds of civil resistance and nonviolence? That's exactly what they're doing. That's what many people do. And it's just trying to be like, well, then quit sabotaging those kinds of efforts, because those kinds of efforts are there and they're very prevalent and they need to be, you know, but if they're made impossible, that's when people increasingly turn to desperate measures.
How has the Israeli army sabotaged the nonviolent efforts?
Well, you know, in a really simple way, by shooting and arresting anyone who tries to engage in nonviolent civil resistance.
Can you give some examples?
Well, you already gave some, the ISM activists who had been shot. But on a regular basis, Palestinians who organize nonviolent civil resistance, this automatically makes them a threat because they're opposing Israeli interests. So many, the best thing I can say is there's, if you like, before I leave, I can offer you some websites where people can kind of get all of this documentation rather than me trying to go into many, many, many stories.
But you were involved. You said that you were fired upon. Is that
yes,
right?
Actually, yes. This was in 2002, my first visit, and you alluded to the Australian activist who was severely injured by a shot to the gut. I was there on that day, and yes, I can vouch for the fact that one may be in a group of nonviolent activists and be fired upon by an Israeli tank. You know, I can say that that happens, because that's happened to me.
Hmm. So, yeah, I guess we can conclude with some websites and information that you, maybe you even have some books, whatever you think might be helpful to people.
Yeah, some of the best places I think to look for information on the web, at least, are electronicintifada.org is a really great website. PalSolidarity.org is the ISM website, and that's constantly posting press releases and eyewitness reports from the field, from various volunteers out in the field. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza is a really good site because it's hard to get in there and get accurate information. So pchrgaza.org is that one. PalestineMonitor.org has a lot of really good fact sheets. Oh, and there's a friend of mine, Jacob Pace, who's from Santa Cruz. He's has a website of his own, which is a really good site with lots and lots of links for great information. And he also lists a lot of the good social justice and human rights organizations on both sides of the Green Line. And his website, where you can find a lot of those links, is RCNV, that's the Resource Center for Nonviolence here, rcnv.org/Gaza. And those are probably my top picks for places to kind of continue to monitor information.
I'll add one, if I may, and that is Beth Salim's website.
Oh, definitely, yes.
An Israeli human rights group, and they monitor the situation in the occupied territories. Their website is BTSELEM.
Oh, another one is the Alternative Information Center, which is another joint Palestinian-Israeli.
What's that website?
Oh, shoot. I think it just might be... Well, alternate hyphen information. I would Google
people
it.
People can put it
Google
in.
It.
Alternative Information Center?
Yeah. And it's based in Beit Sahor, which is a suburb of Bethlehem, very close to Jerusalem also.
Joint Israeli-Palestinian group.
They put out really good publications and web online reports.
Well, thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having
really
me here.
I appreciate it. You've been listening to 101.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, and I've been speaking with Maya Ramnath. She's a UCSC grad student and activist in the global justice and anti-war movements, and we've been talking about her trips with the International Solidarity Movement twice. She's been to the West Bank with the ISM, most recently in December and January. Thanks again so much for joining me today.
Thank you.